Hello, I'm Lina Khmudu. Welcome to Health Chat. On the show today, we'll have a discussion about the impact of climate change on gender. But first, an anti-COVID drug widely used across the world may have caused mutations in the virus, researchers said Monday. But there was no evidence that the changes had led to more dangerous variants. Pharmaceutical giant Merck's antiviral pill, molnupiravir, was one of the earliest treatments rolled out during the pandemic to prevent COVID becoming more severe in vulnerable people. Researchers say the COVID vaccine widely used across the world may have caused a mutation in a new UK-led study. Researchers have shown that molnupiravir can give rise to significantly mutated viruses which remain viable, quote, according to them. Pharmaceutical giant Merck's antiviral pill molnupiravir was one of the earliest treatments rolled out during the pandemic to prevent COVID becoming more severe. The drug, which is taken orally over a five-day course, works mainly by creating mutations in the virus with the goal of weakening and killing it. The researchers say none of the variants that have swept the world were due to the drug. However, they say it is very difficult to predict whether molnupiravir treatment could potentially lead to a new widely circulating variant which people don't have prior immunity to. Now to South Sudan, where the Sudanese Doctors Union has warned in a statement that the health situation in the southeastern state of Gedaref on the border with Ethiopia is deteriorating at a horrific rate. It says thousands have been infected with dengue fever and hundreds have died of dengue fever and acute watery diarrhea have in Wanton, Sudan, medics reported on Monday. They warned that catastrophic spreads that could overwhelm the country's decimated health system is ongoing. 80% of the hospitals in Sudan are out of service due to the war, according to the United Nations. Even before the war, the fragile healthcare system struggled to contain the annual disease outbreaks that accompany the country's rainy season starting in June, including malaria endemic in Sudan and dengue fever. Dengue is a mosquito-borne disease that causes high fever, headaches, nausea, vomiting, muscle pain, and, in the most serious cases, bleeding that can lead to death. We turn now to sleep deprivation. Experts agree our sleeping habits has a direct impact on our health overall. They say a good sleep improves brain performance, a person's mood and health, according to the U.S. National Institute of Health. And not getting enough sleep, quality sleep, that is, regularly, raises the risk of many diseases and disorders such as heart disease, dementia, and obesity. There are many reasons that can affect a good sleep, including sleep disorders like insomnia, when people struggle to sleep, and sleep paralysis, a feeling of being conscious but unable to move. Despite its importance, many people struggle to get enough quality sleep. VOA's Alula Kebede spoke to an expert who shared insights on the effects of sleep deprivation and how to improve sleep habits for better overall health. Take a listen.
So with regards to the causes of sleep paralysis, there's still a lot of research ongoing about what causes it, and there's no clear set explanation for what causes it. Some people have some theories about what causes it, but what we've seen is that there are certain predisposing factors to developing sleep paralysis. Things like having narcolepsy, which is where you get these bouts of sleep that are so irresistible, you just fall asleep during the day. Then suffering from insomnia, people who sleep in a supine position. So if you sleep facing up, you're at an increased risk of actually having an episode of sleep paralysis. The way to prevent episodes of sleep paralysis is by having what's known as good sleep hygiene, a group of actions or habits that promote better quality sleep. Some of the things which help with this is going to bed at the same time every single day, getting at least 8 hours of good quality restful sleep, avoiding any screens that emit especially blue light, roughly 30 minutes before bed, avoiding consuming anything like caffeine or alcohol.
That was Dr. Tayo Opakunle, his general practitioner at the Karen Hospital in Nairobi. He was speaking on some causes of sleep paralysis and sharing some solutions. Now, Mark Raymond Jr. and his dedicated team are revolutionizing how people with disabilities approach their health and well-being. At the Split Second Fitness Center in New Orleans, they provide resources and programs tailored to the special needs of each of their clients' disabilities. In the process, they are breaking down barriers and improving the quality of life for the people they serve. Aaron Fedor shows us how.
Yeah, let's go. Push. Two.
Split Second Foundation is a nonprofit organization committed to breaking barriers for people with disabilities. And how we do that is by creating resources and programs for people to improve their quality of life. Split Second Fitness is the first rehab-based fitness center in the Gulf South, specifically for people who've had paralysis, amputations, or some type of neurological condition, although now we're seeing people even in like the aging population. The significance was, again, a lot of these people were going through health-related situations and being really put in a box with how many visitations they got from insurance. And once they were discharged, they had no place to go to continue their recovery and rehab journey. We've become that place. Unfortunately, rehab isn't just a linear, like, you're done in 9 months kind of thing, right?
We did a just pushing up movement. There you go, push up. There you go.
Ooh. We founded Split Second Foundation in April of 2018. We opened the first fitness center in February of 2021. It started with me. July 4th, 2016, I had a diving accident that left me a C4 quadriplegic. Dove into shallow water and had a burst fracture at the C5 level in my neck. Woke up in the hospital 3 weeks later on a ventilator to the news that I was paralyzed and may never walk, may never breathe on my own again. I had a really strong support system. And even in my darkest days, they didn't let me get too down. We, after the first year here in New Orleans, we went to Sacramento to check out a facility similar to what we operate now. And that was where I really like saw the importance of community, the importance of having a space that was for me and seeing other people like me thriving, especially immediately after that, still dealing with some of the grief and the depression. That I think was where I saw like that light in the darkness. And I wanted to be able to provide that light to everybody else here that didn't have it. But right now, Split Second Foundation operates two programs and they're very unique. Split Second Fitness and Split Second Cares.
That was fitness instructor Mark Raymond Jr. with the Split Second Fitness Center in New Orleans. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
This week on Straight Talk Africa, Niger has expelled the French ambassador and Paris says it's ending its military presence in the West African nation. It's the latest example of anti-French sentiment sweeping parts of West Africa, where some countries have seen military coups. What's the future of France in West Africa? And is there a new balance of power in the region? Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
Welcome back to Health Chat. Now, the Sleep Foundation describes sleep paralysis as the loss of muscle control known as atonia. And we looked at sleep paralysis earlier. Now, let's turn to sweeteners. We use them in our drinks every day. We use them to replace sugar, but they may be bad for your health. That's according to experts. They say that sweeteners can be very detrimental to your health. Get this. Personal health monitoring is coming to the most private places. We are looking at toilets, a smart toilet. Matt Diebold looks at new devices that track human waste in this edition of Logon. Take a listen.
Each day, vast amounts of valuable health information are flushed down toilets. Stanford School of Medicine's Sungmin Park says there is an opportunity to improve health by closely monitoring human waste.
Here's a prototype that we work on.
Park is developing a smart toilet that can gather visual information about a user's stool and send it to healthcare providers.
And we're looking at those excreta with computer vision and artificial intelligence to tell the early disease detection or even prevention of disease.
The camera is located right behind this housing here.
Park is working with South Korean manufacturer Ezen to develop the first consumer version, which will be an add-on to an existing toilet, with the capability to send basic health and nutrition advice to a user's phone. Park says future versions could monitor many conditions and even detect early signs of cancer. U-Scan, a device from French company Withings, samples urine.
Urine is an amazing source of health information. Urine contains up to 3,000 chemical compounds.
The system uses replaceable cartridges with enough tests for 90 days.
All you have to do is just to urinate, and that's it.
A tiny pump is heat-activated and delivers drops of urine to a test strip,
which will react with urine and generate a color change, which we detect with an optical sensor.
Test results appear on the app within minutes. Cartridges for monitoring fertility and nutrition will be available first. Tech is coming to the toilet, but it remains to be seen if users are ready to welcome these innovations into their most private routines. Matt Dibble for VOA News, Palo Alto, California.
We turn now to climate change. Experts say climate disasters are causing devastation around the world, and the change in climate is projected to increase threats to human health, particularly in lower-income populations. Among other things, this affects people's health with changes in the ranges of disease vectors, water quality, and food availability. Many women are often vulnerable to the impact of climate change. For more insight, I spoke with Dr. Nora Obu. She is a health integration and East Africa director for the organization Women Lift Health. Take a listen.
Yeah, there's all the intersection, and sometimes people have never quite put the connection and have looked at climate change in isolation, but it is feeding into health, into our food systems, into gender issues as well. But when you look specifically at health, we can see that the climate crisis, as it presents in famine, drought, and floods, this will affect, populations. And so it means that there will be people in crisis, whether it's injuries that result from it, whether it's the diarrheal diseases or respiratory infections that are coming up from carbon emissions and, with climate change or climate sensitive changes that are affecting health, to include diarrheal diseases. Those are things that are health related. And so when we're looking at our leading diseases or disease prevalence, where we're talking about respiratory illnesses or diarrheal illnesses, there is a climate change link to it, because the heat and the changing in rain patterns and what I've just described earlier, those are affecting the human population. And we know that human health is the face of climate change. So yes, there's all the intersection that comes with it.
What is the impact of climate change on populations on the ground when it comes to Africa?
Yeah, on the ground, of course, there's the issue of immigration. We can see, people who are dying in the process of immigrating to the European countries. Where are they moving? Because their land is no longer sustaining them. It's not agriculturally viable anymore. The weather patterns have changed. The rain is not presenting in terms of the patterns as it usually has. And so there's a lot of famine and drought. And we're talking about West Africa all the way to the Horn of Africa, the East Horn of Africa. And so famine and, you know, reduced usage of land is causing migration. And you can see all the deaths that are resulting in the seas, in the northern seas, as a result of human displacement, as a result, because they cannot produce food. On the other hand, the people who are remaining then are facing starvation and malnutrition consequently. And what does that mean for the future? Because if you're having a child or a pregnant mother who's not nutritionally fit even to carry a child, then it means that we are giving birth to children who are malnourished already, and the mother is suffering and cannot feed the child. And so what generation are we looking at? Because then the development of the child is also affected. And so we are looking at the impact as well in future generations in terms of the quality of the humans that we are producing in the region. Over and above that, when we look at floods, we look at displacements, we look at consequent refugee populations, this is resulting in, you know, exactly what we are trying to manage in terms of economics. We cannot, countries cannot be economically viable if populations are displaced and they're not working and they're not producing. Then it means that the country is also not developing and not producing enough resources to manage their population. So there's all the effect over and above that, from displacement to the diseases that we are currently seeing, and therefore increased disease burden for countries. And it means that we can't focus our resources to improving other things, but, you know, just managing the crisis, and the resources are not enough. So we're getting into a cycle of poverty, you know, and human suffering that is continuing. Yet when we look at climate change, in all honesty, we are only contributing 3.8% to the global gas emissions that are being produced, yet we are suffering the brunt. So this is something that is truly an injustice for Africa.
Reports show that women and girls are affected in very specific ways and in high numbers. What are your thoughts?
This is a really big issue, again, and looking at the climate change and its intersection with gender, the gender issues that exist. Gender equality still exists, and climate change is only just worsening the situation. And when we look at women, women are the ones who are tilling the land, producing food, managing households. They become vulnerable because they're also the most poor. And we see that almost 63% of the world's poor who are women are in Africa. So you can imagine in climate change, where your land is no longer viable, how do you produce for the household? How do you even give birth to a healthy child? And the second thing, when we look at women in that vulnerable space, if they're facing famine, we have women who are walking over six kilometers just to collect 20 liters of water. In that pathway to getting to water, she's exposed to a lot of dangers, whether it's wildlife or it's even raping from men. And therefore, what we're referring to as gender-based violence is also representing as a result of climate change. So we can see the challenges women are facing because of they not being able to produce, they not being able to sustain their health, they not being able to manage their households, and the dangers that they are put when they're displaced or have to really walk great kilometers just to get water or food for survival. So indeed, climate change has to be looked at all intersections in health and in gender as well. And at this time, as we discuss around women, yes.
So beyond the rhetoric, how can African countries and institutions working in the climate and health spaces begin to center women in climate and health conversation? And what impact would these actions have?
I want to just run a parallel. Thank you, Ninod, for that question. Because just as we see it in health, there's underrepresentation of women at the decision-making table. Similarly, that's what's happening in the climate area, in the climate change discussions. And so when we're looking at women's place and we look at climate change and we're looking at adaptation and mitigation strategies, when we look at adaptation, for instance, most of it will happen really at the community level. It will be community-led. Who is at the community? This is the woman. As I've described her role in the community, she's already a leader, she's resilient, and she knows the localized situation where she is. If she is not, therefore, represented in these decision-making tables, then we're losing on the wealth of expertise, experience, and, you know, the natural leadership skills that they would bring on the table so that we can have sustainable climate change solutions. So what I am still advocating, and a lot of women are also advocating, that we need to be in these decision-making tables. Leadership is so critical in this process. When we're talking about, you know, the financing, that even with the Africa Climate Summit, there have been pledges made. How will that money roll down to the mitigation and adaptation, and particularly adaptation efforts? How will that roll down to the grassroots for impact? And we need to see accountability. We need to see the groups that have been supported with this financing and see that their work has actually caused impact, even as much as it would be in the long term. So indeed, women must be at the table. They only bring their, you know, their expertise, their leadership. We are not victims anymore. We are agents of change, and we just must be in these tables.
What can people do? Perhaps some small steps they can take to protect themselves.
You know, we have to start from the point of understanding what climate change is, because climate change as a term looks so far away from the things that we are dealing with community, regionally, globally. We have to make it, we need to understand what climate change and what climate crisis is coming, because when you understand the problem, then you can address the need, as it were. And of course, at community level, then we would want to move to developing resilience, in essence. And what we are looking at, of course, is looking at renewable energy resources, whether it's using better use of charcoal. For instance, we have different forms of charcoal that reduce gas emissions as opposed to the normal, how we always develop charcoal. So there are very many innovative ways in which we're doing this. There's use of solar energy as well. There's use of you know, different ways in which we can ensure and safeguard against famine or a failed crop. So this is also a call to governments to support and, you know, look at climate insurance, for instance, so that when we very know that, for instance, in Africa, agriculture is very important. And when the patterns are changing, the chances of crop failure are high. Can we have climate insurance for such persons? So these are some of just the examples that we can look at community level in terms of fuel use, fuel production, and looking at renewable energy, and also just planting trees, because these are natural carbon sinkers. So these are the things that I would be advocating for. And of course, there has to be financed for sustainability. They have to be owned. So we must make the communities part and parcel of this discussion around managing climate crisis.
And briefly, what are some of the main takeaways for you from the conference?
The main takeaways, number one, it is exciting that we had the first inaugural Africa Climate Summit here in Nairobi. For me, it presented African voices coming together, a collective coming together before COP28, because when we've got into COP28 previously, we've been a bit scattered. And there's nothing as good as having one voice to negotiate on the changes we want to see. We want to see a lot of climate financing going both to mitigation and adaptation efforts. We want to see legislature around it. We want to see debt for nature swaps, for instance, because we cannot be under debt and yet we are not the ones contributing to all the majority of the gas emissions. And so why should we be under debt? We should have some way in which we are balancing that with what we need to do to address climate change. I'm excited to see the legislature that's coming across to ensure that climate change is an agenda and an initiative being carried around from government to local levels. So when I'm seeing that and, you know, the commitments to financing, that is really exciting. I'm also excited about the youth agenda, because that is part of addressing the climate injustice. They're the ones who are going to face the brunt of this climate crisis that we, in our generation, you know, contributed to. So there must be part and parcel of designing what their future is going to be like. And when I talk about the youth, I'm also talking about all other vulnerable populations, including persons with disabilities, women, the elderly, the whole spectrum. We must be all together as a collective for diverse and equitable leadership to address climate change.
That was Dr. Nora Obudo, Health Integration and East Africa Director for the organization Women Lift Health, speaking to us from the Africa Climate Summit in Nairobi, Kenya.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia when we debate critical and controversial issues of our day. You can listen to the program following VOA News every Saturday and Sunday, either on the radio or online at voaafrica.com and other online podcast websites. That's Encounter on the Voice of America.
I'm Nabil Biagio, and here's what's coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sudan's army chief says he wants the conflict with the paramilitary RSF to end and move toward a civilian government. And United Nations and South Sudanese officials are condemning an attack on a humanitarian convoy that left two people dead. These stories and more at 16th RD UTC in Juba and 1700 UTC in Kenya on VOA Africa.
One of the world's most common artificial sweeteners has been declared a possible carcinogen by a leading global health body, according to two sources familiar with the process. Julie Satherwaite of Reuters report.
Could drinking diet sodas, chewing gum, and eating yogurt lead to cancer? The World Health Organization is set to label aspartame, an artificial sweetener found in these products, a possible cancer risk. But will consumers be willing to kick the habit?
It seems like everything causes cancer these days.
I always knew it kind of like tastes funny.
I'd rather even have sugar instead of aspartame.
Discovered in 1965 by an American chemist and approved by the FDA 9 years later, aspartame is about 200 times sweeter than regular table sugar. It has almost zero calories, so it became popular with increasingly diet-conscious consumers. Shoppers can find it in everything, from Weight Watchers yogurts to some Snapple drinks and Mars's extra chewing gum.
It's convenient for companies to kind of construct what we call a health halo around some of these products.
Noah Pramsma is a nutrition education coordinator with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine.
Unfortunately, in this case, as you dig a little deeper, you realize that sometimes something like a diet soda might not quite be the health food that we might have hoped.
Food companies now need to decide whether to fight back against the labeling, ignore it, or find alternative sweeteners to use. However, recent recipe tweaks by soft drinks giant PepsiCo demonstrate the struggle of balancing health concerns with taste. PepsiCo removed aspartame from sodas in 2015, only to bring it back a year later, and then remove it again in 2020.
You know, the consumer taste is a very, very difficult thing to get right.
Here's Adam Coons, a portfolio manager at Winthrop Capital Management.
We do see, you know, the big soda manufacturers like Pepsi and Coke changing their formula over time. Now, this takes time because you can't just say, hey, we're going to replace one sweetener with another. Taste is what drives the majority of the sales with one manufacturer over another.
Reuters sources say the International Agency for Research on Cancer, an arm of the WHO, will list aspartame as a possible carcinogen in July, putting it in the same category as lead and some pesticides. However, the IARC has two more serious categories, probably carcinogenic and carcinogenic. The latter category includes tobacco and alcohol. Analysts say, like with smoking, it could be a while before a behavior shift is seen.
The consumer will continue to do something that they know is somewhat harmful to their health for quite a while. It takes a big shift. I mean, we saw it in cigarettes. You know, everyone knows that it causes cancer, yet there's still a product, right?
And that's all for this edition of Health Chat. For more health news and medical breakthroughs, visit voaafrica.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linor Mudu, in Washington, with producer Nicole Peters. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.